You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. Benjamin Netanyahu has been a fixture of Israeli politics for three decades. Today, he finds himself facing his greatest political challenge ever in the wake of the October 7th terrorist attacks by Hamas. The attacks took the lives of over 1,000 Israeli civilians, as well as hundreds of active-duty security personnel. And the crisis is by no means over, with more than 200 Israeli nationals being held prisoner by Hamas. Now, prior to the attacks, Netanyahu was already an embattled figure, facing a corruption trial and protests over overhauls to the judiciary that have divided the country. Now Netanyahu faces the prospects of a bloody ground war, potentially on multiple fronts. In this episode, we'll explore the mood on the ground in Israel, how that may shape Netanyahu's decision-making, and what the ongoing crisis means for the future of his government, his legacy, the fate of the Israeli state, and the question of Israeli-Palestinian peace. To help us unpack all this, we're joined by Merav Zonshine, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. Merav is an expert on Israel's domestic politics and Israeli-Palestinian relations. She's contributed to The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other respected publications. Merav, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Arif.
Before I ask you the first question, I just wanted to note for our audience that this episode is part of a series that looks at the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian war from multiple angles. Last week, we devoted a full episode to how the war is impacting Palestinians, and this episode focuses on dynamics in Israel, centering around the leadership of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's important to note that at the time of the recording of this episode, over 7,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed by Israel in Gaza, according to local authorities. So, Merav, let's talk about the mood on the ground in Israel. The October 7th attacks by Hamas were not only massive in their scale, but also gruesome in their nature. Now, it's been almost 3 weeks since the attacks. Has public sentiment evolved over this time? And what are Israelis demanding right now from their government?
So, it's hard to overstate just how game-changing this event was and how traumatic for Israeli society it has been, and also that the details of what exactly went on that day on October 7th are still developing and being unfolded and discovered. Not only are the bodies still being identified, there's been a real difficulty in identifying all the bodies. Some of them literally were burned to bone and dust, but also what exactly happened, how did the Hamas militants get in? And, you know, they're starting to leak videos of things that happened in preparation on the Gaza border beforehand. And so there's just a lot of open-ended questions, a lot of things unanswered. And at the same time, you still have families whose, relatives are captive in Gaza. And the utmost concern now for much of Israel is to get them back home. And it's already been almost 3 weeks. So it's, extremely tense. And I think in general across the country, but certainly in the south, where over 100,000 Israelis have had to evacuate, some are homeless, some don't know when they'll be able to go back. In the north, with the Hezbollah exchanges of fire, some people have also left of their own will or have evacuated. So you have also just a lot of Israelis who aren't in their houses, don't know when they can go back. And the general sense of security and safety has been completely shattered. So you really have a country in shock. At the same time, you also have a country in serious anger and serious rage at Hamas, but also at its own government, because it's very, very clear to many, many Israelis that this was a huge failure, not only of the military echelon, but of the political echelon. And in some cases, people really see that Netanyahu's policies themselves have just led us to a point in which we can't go back. Now, there's a split, of course, in terms of how they understand what should be done in Gaza and with Hamas. A small minority, I think, of Israelis understand that just bombing Gaza relentlessly like it has in the past is not going to bring a solution. But there really isn't another alternative right now that's being put forward. So Israelis are kind of waiting to see what happens with a ground invasion. I think they're very, very concerned about what's going to happen to it, our own forces, but also the regionally, how it might escalate. So there's a lot of open questions. There's a lot of concern. And, you know, a lot of people don't trust this government to lead us through the war. But at the same time, nobody's actually saying right now Netanyahu has to leave. I mean, very few. And there's not any protests in the streets like there were up until now. So everything has kind of come to a grinding halt. And I think slowly, even though there's still rockets flying, slowly people are trying to start to get back to things. But for example, the education system has been pretty much shut down since October 7th. So things are still slowly but surely trying to, you know, get back to some kind of crazy routine.
Now, in terms of the public's demands for a response to the Hamas attacks, to what extent is whoever rules Israel in the coming weeks and months constrained by what the public wants? Because naturally, you know, the response to the kind of images that one, you know, they've seen in terms of the Hamas attacks and the details of the attacks, you know, trigger a visceral response. So I'm wondering, in terms of elite decision-making, how important is the public response and what impact does that have on whoever rules Israel?
Well, I guess the public, you know, the public fear now and kind of the general sentiment that we can no longer coexist with a Hamas on our border is clear across the board. Even, you know, there's nobody who thinks that Hamas can remain intact the way that it is. But when it comes specifically to the hostages, I think there's a very big difference between the public sentiment and the government, and specifically Netanyahu, who has spoken almost not at all about the hostages in any of his public statements. And in general, the government has not seemed to prioritize it. And I know from speaking to some officials here that it seems like that's a secondary priority right now because they've put such a tall order of dismantling and destroying Hamas, that's the number one concern. And there might be a lot of collateral damage involved in that. And so the hostage situation, I think, for the public is the number one priority. And in the past, Israel has, you know, prioritized. And for example, Gilad Shalit, who was taken captive in Gaza, was released for many, many Palestinian prisoners, including Yahya Sinwar, who is now, you know, heading Hamas. So most Israelis want them home, whatever the price. That's the sentiment. But the government and the military see it quite differently.
And the families of the kidnapping victims, too, have coalesced. They've formed a kind of a lobby group, the Hostage and Missing Families Forum. We've seen some of them, you know, express opinions about what they expect from the response. Some have expressed fears that Israel's aerial bombing campaign and even a ground offensive could put the hostages in danger. So I'm wondering, you said that the fate of the hostages is very important for the general for the general public, for the public at large. But how important in terms of shaping the government's response are the families of the hostage victims themselves?
It doesn't seem like that's really a factor here because they have much bigger fish to fry, right? They have to figure out how to remove Hamas from power. And as I said, that's the priority. I do think that the combination of the families' pressure and also the families are really making demands in English. They are, you know, making their signs, social media campaigns in English. I think they feel maybe a combination of the Israeli government isn't going to do this for us, but also that this is a global issue, and also that there's foreign nationals, many U.S. citizens and others who are there. There's Thai nationals who are workers in Israel, and they feel like this is a global issue that they must, you know, appeal to the world. And I think the combination of their demands, along with the U.S. seemingly putting pressure on Israel to delay the ground invasion for the ability to negotiate some kind of prisoner release through Qatar and Egypt. So that's something that I think is a channel that's taking place. It's really actually very hard to understand what exactly the government's agenda is. I think it's in a lot of disarray. And I think some people think Netanyahu is either indecisive or averse to taking any serious action. Others think this is kind of a calculated strategy of pushing things along until, you know, something happens that will force more action. So it's hard for me to say exactly what the government is thinking right now, but you know, there are now a few days that we have that supposedly Israel has decided to delay this ground invasion in the hopes of a hostage release. So I think the families are really, really, you know, praying that this is going to happen.
You talked about the issue of disarray in the Israeli government, and that was going to be my next question. You know, Netanyahu has come under criticism from many sides, as you noted. A poll in the Maariv newspaper suggests that up to 80% of Israelis believe that he should take responsibility for the security failures that led to the October 7th attacks. And I think his statements yesterday kind of move in that direction, though he, you know, fell short of really claiming accountability for what happened, at least in terms of the intelligence failure and all that. Now, some have called for his resignation. Others, including officials in the IDF or retired IDF officials, have criticized many of his appointments, including the lead hostage coordinator, Gal Hirsch. So I'm wondering, how severe is the institutional disarray in Israel? And to what extent is it the result of Netanyahu's own political machinations over the past year as he's faced these corruption charges?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the failure and the kind of trauma that's happening in Israel is not just as a result of what happened on October 7th, but everything that's happened since then, because even just the basic services of providing transportation for reservists to get to where they need to go, for providing hotels and places of shelter for the evacuated families and the victims, all the kind of, you know, logistics of dealing with this issue, and there's a lot to deal with on a mass scale, is something that the government hasn't really properly been able to organize and coordinate. And we've seen that civilians have become kind of the backbone of the functioning of this country. And in a lot of ways, the very protest movement against Netanyahu and this government's judicial overhaul plan went from protesting the government to basically providing services and food and care for the people who are, you know, currently suffering in Israel. So you kind of see like a very clear failure of the state right now. And that's a big part of what people are feeling and is, you know, is causing so many people, I think, to realize that Netanyahu is clearly not up for the challenge, and that this government, it's not only the last year of this government, it's years and years of corruption and consolidation of power and political appointments. It's, you know, very open in the Israeli media that a lot of the people, there's either certain ministries that aren't staffed because they've just been left unstaffed, or they've been staffed by people who aren't skilled in these specific positions. And you can see that, you know, years of this kind of approach has just really collapsed Israel's ability to for its institutions to function. And everything has become politicized. And, you know, all of it is just, you know, opportunism and populism. And, you know, that's really epitomized by how Netanyahu has not even been able to speak to the public in a way that they feel there's any empathy. When Biden came to Israel at the beginning of this war, he was the one who provided that kind of sentiment and sympathy and empathy for the Israeli public and made the hostages a priority. Netanyahu hasn't done that. So there's really a lot of disarray. And there's also the issue of the political versus the military tensions, because as you said, there's a lot of security officials who, as former security officials specifically, who have come out against Netanyahu even before the October 7th attack. Because of his leading Israel less and less from a place of democracy. And at this point, that's become even more extreme. I mean, they just, you know, speak out against him as somebody who can't be trusted. So you have a situation in which nobody trusts Netanyahu, but nobody really knows how to remove him from power. And because we're in a crisis of war, many just assume that he'll stay around until we finish whatever this job is and then deal with that, right? But for Netanyahu to actually, I guess, be challenged, there would have to be either mass protests in the street, which is very challenging when you have rockets and a crisis, or you would have to have major defectors from his own party destabilize the government. And neither of those things are taking place right now.
Mm. You keep on anticipating my next questions. On that point of the kind of the disconnect that we're seeing between the political leadership and the security leadership in Israel, over the past year or so, we've had some of that rise to the surface at least in terms of news reporting, where, you know, there's speculation that some of his appointments, like, you know, his appointments of political allies like Gal Hirsch, reflect his distrust of Mossad. The head of Mossad, David Barney, reportedly allowed the organization's employees to take part in the protests against the so-called judicial reforms earlier this year. So I'm wondering, how severe is that disconnect? And do you see any potential impact on how this war is pursued?
Yeah, so I mean, the disconnect is there. The tension is there. There's also, it's not just Netanyahu and the security officials. It's also the people who make up the government and head the different ministries, the Minister of Treasury, the Minister of National Security, who are from the far settler right, who, you know, as far as the military is concerned, are not really skilled to do their job. I mean, in the case of the National Security Advisor, National Security Minister, in the case of the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, you know, he has clearly allocated the budget towards expansionism and annexation of the West Bank. And so you have like a much, much deeper and bigger divide between the political echelon and the military echelon, in the sense that the military are the people on the ground who need to deal with the day to day issues of security. And like, if you look at the West Bank specifically, which is also experiencing a lot of violence against Palestinians, you know, you have a political echelon inciting against Palestinians, settlers being, you know, just reigning with impunity, and then the military having to deal with the, you know, backlash and repercussions of that. And Netanyahu has basically just allowed all this to happen and encouraged it to happen. And the military isn't also doing anything about it, but they at least openly condemn it and say that it has to stop. So there's really very, very deep divides. As far as the specific war cabinet and the kind of, you know, I think the people who joined the war cabinet with Netanyahu are all very well-experienced veteran military chiefs. Benny Gantz worked with Netanyahu. He was chief of staff, the IDF, defense minister. They probably are even more aggressive in terms of their understanding of how to deal with Gaza than Netanyahu would be. I don't think that they're a moderating force, but I think they are probably a lot more, you know, well-versed in the different scenarios that should be taken, and possibly also at better relations with their U.S. counterparts to deal with it.
Now, I just want to go deeper into this question of the degrading of Israeli institutions under Netanyahu. He's ruled the country for roughly 13 of the past 14 and a half years. And Israel, at least until these attacks, was more divided than ever before. Faith in public institutions has declined. And some have said that even that, you know, Shin Bet, the leading Israeli internal security organization, has been politicized by Netanyahu. So I'm wondering, when we look at the October 7th attacks, you know, they were pretty precise in terms of how they targeted intelligence facilities, you know, along the border with Gaza. And the Israeli response was, you know, according to some accounts, pretty chaotic. So I'm wondering how, you know, this period of disarray and Netanyahu's long rule over Israel has degraded the quality of Israel's security institutions, and specifically with respect to the October 7th attacks. Is that a bit of a stretch in making that connection?
No, I think, I mean, you know, Israel still has, you know, the strongest military in the region, and it has a lot of resources and technology, and it exports, you know, its cyber surveillance technology, which is well documented, and it has the capacity. But I think what we saw on October 7th is that your military and economic prowess is only as strong as the people who are running it. And I think what we saw is just years and years of Israelis feeling, in general, but specifically the leadership, feeling that they can do as they want and not pay a price for it, and that there's a certain invincibility to their power. And when you know, compound that with the ability to normalize relations with Arab countries who have in the past, you know, not been willing to do that, then you kind of just feel this hubris. And so maybe they were just becoming kind of complacent, like we don't have to. And there's more to that. I mean, there's also the fact that of all the different fronts that Israel is dealing with and all the different threats, Gaza was like on the back burner, right? There have been people who have over the years warned about the situation, and this notion that Hamas could be deterred and that we can just give them money and to keep them off the brink of disaster and, you know, it'll be fine. I mean, so, you know, that concept clearly shattered. But Gaza was the last thing on the security officials' minds, clearly. And so even if they had, which is some Israeli reports show that they did have some intelligence about what was happening, they just didn't treat it properly. And also you had IDF forces who were diverted to the West Bank to protect settlers. You just basically had a society that thought that it could just not deal with the issue. And that, of course, the larger issue there is that Israelis in general have just occupation and the Palestinian struggle for freedom and for a state has just not been present in Israeli politics for 20 years. It's just not something people talk about. So I think all of these factors led to the kind of inability for Israel to institutionally and politically be prepared for what happened.
Mm. Now, you know, some in Israel have accused Netanyahu of playing an enabling role with Hamas. And it seems to me, at least until the October 7th attacks, there was something like a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two going back to the 1990s. Hamas's suicide attacks helped Netanyahu come to power for the first time in 1996 when he defeated Shimon Peres. And it seems like Hamas has been that non-partner for peace that he's desired. And their presence in Gaza, their domination there, allows him to preserve the political status quo and then change facts on the ground, specifically with settlement expansion. Do you agree with that, or is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, no, I think that they have been mutually reinforcing. You know, it's well known that Netanyahu's policies over the years, and again, not just Netanyahu, Israeli governments, but he has dominated politics for the last 15 years, but it has been to not engage with the Palestinian Authority, to kind of, you know, make it this kind of subcontractor of the military occupation and weaken it and not give it any credibility and not enter into a serious peace process, you know, while claiming to want a two-state solution for a while and then more recently in recent years, clearly breaking from that. And Hamas provided the perfect alibi for Israel to not have to engage with Palestinians in a real way. And, you know, the use of force in this conflict is also something that if you look at all the times that Israel has tried to enter into some kind of peace agreement, it's been after periods of intifada, periods of suicide bombings. So, you know, when Palestinians are nonviolent and when they protest, that usually or almost categorically has been rejected and sidelined. It's when they use force that all of a sudden Israel, you know, comes to the table. So that has been a reinforcing relationship between Israel and Hamas. And Israel's tactic of separating and fragmenting the West Bank from Gaza, which is something that it's very clearly done. I mean, it separates Palestinians across all the different areas in which they live in Israel and in the occupied territories. That's something that, you know, has also been playing a role in this, because it thought that it could just, you know, separate them and that there would be, you know, no connection between the arenas. And what we've seen in the last couple of years, that Hamas and other parts of this axis of Iran and different elements within the West Bank as well are connecting the arena. So if something happens in Jerusalem, then Israel might feel that from the Gaza Strip or from the West Bank. It can't just do what it wants in different geographical locations and not, you know, not pay a price for it. So that is something that has kind of, the policy that Israel has employed clearly hasn't worked.
Yeah. And part of that policy has been, as you touched upon a bit earlier, that push for normalization with Arab and Muslim majority states. And that seems to me to be part of Netanyahu and the Israeli security establishment's attempts to change the facts on the ground by sidelining the Arab and Muslim majority states that had once said that the establishment of a Palestinian state is a prerequisite for their normalizing relations with Israel. Now, I'm wondering, you know, that push for normalization, I think there's an obvious linkage to Israel's relationship with the Palestinians and the question of a Palestinian state. But I'm wondering how much of that push for normalization was also motivated by Netanyahu's own battle for political survival that, you know, let's say, for example, getting a deal with Saudi Arabia would dramatically improve his standing in Israel and then serve as a buffer against these kind of corruption changes. Do you see any linkage between the two?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, normalizing with Saudi Arabia would be a just a clean win-win situation for Israel. But I think, you know, the specific Saudi-Israel track, normalization track, is really more about the U.S. foreign policy's interests and Saudi Arabia's, you know, domestic interests and foreign policy interests. And, you know, we can get into that. But, you know, Saudi Arabia has kind of been playing the U.S. against China, and it has its own interests. So in some ways, you know, Israel has become at the center of this, and it certainly has a lot to gain. But I really think this is actually an issue that has a lot more to do with those players than with Israel. But in terms of Israel's, you know, general relationship to the Gulf countries, you know, to these normalizations, I mean, this is something that very clearly was about, you know, economic and military interests on both sides, and really not about peace because they're not at war. And so, it, you know, Netanyahu has been very successful along with Trump in selling it as a peace deal when really that's not what it's about. And Netanyahu also, you know, has a legacy to deal with and to worry about. And his whole career has been based on not just rejectionism of the of a Palestinian state, but also the threat from Iran. So it's, you know, very much in his interest, I guess, in some ways, Israel tried to create a kind of, you know, Arab NATO against Iran with the U.S. That didn't really pan out. But, it, you know, Netanyahu was basically able to strike a deal with the UAE and Bahrain and sell it as if it was in exchange for stopping annexation. And when you think about, you know, how absurd and outrageous that is, right? A, because that shouldn't be the swap, and B, because Israel is de facto annexing anyway. But, you know, in effect, the whole Netanyahu doctrine that we can make kind of peace or normalize and make the Arab-Israeli conflict go away before we deal with the Palestinian issue, clearly that isn't the case. And so I think also, you know, his image as Mr. Security and Mr. Diplomacy, not just in Israel, but in the world, has really, really taken a major hit.
Mm. And, you know, looking at sort of the drivers of the October 7th attacks, you know, it's hard to kind of rationalize, of course, without justifying Hamas's motivations. But I'm wondering, you know, to what extent was this push for normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel a precipitating factor? I mean, this would be just speculation on your part, because in the end, we have to rely on, you know, what Hamas says itself. But I'm wondering if that false sense of security and then the push for normalization was a causal factor in Hamas choosing a catastrophic attack like this.
I mean, I think that it was maybe part of the timing or part of like the last trigger. But, I think it enumerated a bunch of reasons for the attack, you know, having to do with undermining the status quo in Jerusalem and in Al-Aqsa Temple Mount compound, the siege on Gaza, which is something that it has repeatedly demanded be lifted. And so there's, you know, a series of things that are go way deeper. And of course, they are interested in the release of Palestinian prisoners. That's why they employ the tactic of taking hostages. So those are all much deeper, I think, causes. And the Saudi thing is, I think, maybe just like the last kind of trigger and possibly the reason why it happened when it happened.
Mm. Okay. Now, you know, looking at sort of the bigger picture, in Netanyahu's role in sort of shaping the Israel that is today, I'm wondering, you know, he's ruled Israel for roughly 16 years in total. He's been the country's longest serving prime minister for roughly 20% of the country's history. And we look at how Israel has changed over that period. In the 1990s, a majority of Israelis and Palestinians supported a two-state solution. Today, that opinion is only held by a minority of both communities. And the reasonings, you know, of that, of course, go beyond Netanyahu himself. But I think when we look at the Israeli polity, it's arguably become a kind of a center-right country, with religious Zionists and the Haredi population playing a much bigger role. And I, you know, that's something that probably was not thinkable in the early days of Israel in terms of who, you know, led the Zionist movement at that point. So I'm wondering if, even if Netanyahu goes at some point in the coming weeks and months, to what extent is the Israel today a reflection of Netanyahu himself? To what extent is Israel now a country that's been shaped in his image?
Yeah, well, I do think that he's certainly been a major crafter of the way Israel looks today, you know, specifically when it comes to the Palestinian issue. I think we've talked, you know, very clearly about how he has shaped a kind of, you know, rejectionism and really led Israel into a place of more military might and kind of living by the sword and all that. But there's, you know, there's other issues involved here, of course, which has also to do with, like, you know, the coalition electoral politics in Israel, the fact that the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, which has changed in similar ways to the way the Republican Party has changed and become a much more fundamentalist kind of party. But, you know, at some point, first of all, demographically, like you said, the ultra-Orthodox have just become a much bigger part of the Israeli pie, and maybe people didn't account for that early on. But also, you know, Netanyahu's Likud party, which is a secular nationalist party, they kind of conceded over the years. He learned his lesson at some point when he took a hit in elections. He learned that he cannot, I think it was when he tried to make some economic reforms that would have hurt the ultra-Orthodox because they get a lot of subsidies and they're on welfare. And he tried to change that, and then he just lost the next election. So he, you know, has tied his fate and power to the ultra-Orthodox. And that is generally a problem in Israel, and specifically in this parliamentary type of coalition where, you know, a small party with a certain number of seats can kind of, you know, decide the government's direction. So that's also part of it. So that, you know, is not just Netanyahu, but he certainly has kind of been a big player in letting them set the tone. And then there's also other processes, like the fact that the army has become more filled with settlers, the settler right has grown. And also on the back of the Oslo process and the failure of the peace process, the right in general in Israel has really built itself and created, you know, it's just permeated all of Israel's institutions. And this goes much, you know, broader than just Netanyahu. So that there's been all these kind of processes of Israel moving to the right. And then, of course, also Netanyahu's just obsession with the media. And really, the media today in Israel is like a skeleton of what it once was. And is there's almost no real newspaper in Israel except for Haaretz. They're just all, you know, very, very superficial and very geared towards propaganda. And the journalistic ethic here has really, really been deteriorated as a result of Netanyahu's manipulating the media. So that's what Israelis see in their papers and on the evening news has really shaped a lot of its move to the right over the years.
Mm. Now, you talked about the ascendancy of the right and the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. I'm wondering what's left of the left. When you look at public opinion polls on Israeli-Palestinian peace, that seems in some ways to be a dividing line in terms of the political spectrum in Israel. So a vast majority of those who self-identify as being part of the left still believe in a two-state solution, but they're now a minority in their country. And this was a country that was founded, you know, the Zionist movement had many constituent elements, but the sort of, I guess, the center-left tendency, the labor, in very many respects at the forefront. So I'm wondering, where does the left stand today in Israel?
Yeah, well, just on the, like, historical accuracy of the labor movement, I mean, all the Labor Party governments and, you know, the Labor Party dominated Israeli politics for the first 30 years of Israel, and they were all pro-settlement. They all built settlements. None of them were actually truly, I think, dedicated to letting go of that territory and making those concessions. Obviously, it was a little bit of a different time security-wise, but, you know, that's just a misnomer in Israeli history. And then as far as what's, you know, so the left in Israel in that sense, you know, was never necessarily genuinely ready to make those kind of sacrifices. The kind of, you know, real left today is not represented in Israeli politics, and the last election completely shattered any presence of the anti-occupation party Meretz. It's tricky because if you do really push a lot of Israelis, secular liberal Israelis who live in the center of the country, the middle upper class, if you push them to a wall, they'll tell you, yes, we want the occupation to stop. We want settlements to be evacuated, or at least some of them. I mean, there is some consensus that some settlements will never be evacuated, but they'll tell you that they want peace and they want a two-state solution. But I mean, I think the real issue here is not that they want that as an end game, but what they're prepared to do for that to take place. If you ask me, the real left in Israel is primarily made up of a very, very small minority of Jewish Israelis, and primarily now the Arab parties in Israel, and specifically Hadash and the Joint List that has worked together as a faction. Like, in some ways, because of the way in which Israel has operated now for so long as basically one state, one sovereign between the river and the sea, you know, the people who want equal rights, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who make 20% of the population, you know, who are in a very different situation than Palestinians under occupation, they're the ones pushing for a two-state solution and for equal rights for all. They're the kind of only ones who are voicing that with a resolve unequivocally all the time. And the Israelis left, center-left, have moved more and more to the right because they have not been able to create and provide an alternative, especially in the face of Palestinian violence. They just haven't been able to. The notion of land for peace was completely crushed, and they just haven't been able to come up with something that is convincing. So that, unfortunately, the left is completely, you know, decimated. It already was before this, and now with this attack, I'm afraid that it's going to take an even bigger hit. And that's not even taking into account that a lot of liberal lefty Israelis have simply left the country.
Yeah, yeah. So they're, in many ways, they're voting with their feet. Now, final question. In 2016, Netanyahu told CNN's Fareed Zakaria that he'd like to be remembered as the protector of Israel. In the wake of these attacks, what do you think his legacy will be?
Definitely not that. you know, Netanyahu, I think, does really consider himself to be the kind of Jewish superhero for the Jewish people. And, you know, I have personally, in my work in journalism, have followed how he has, you know, made, you know, allies with some of the most anti-Semitic regimes and weaponized the Holocaust and weaponized anti-Semitism for his own political gain. And he's done it time and time again. And he's in general aligned himself in Israel with much more of the global far right than he has with the Western liberal democratic order. I think that clearly Israelis no longer, I think he's pretty much done. I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take, but he's pretty much done. And I think this will really be the main characteristic of his legacy, that he failed. He failed to provide security for Jewish citizens of Israel. And he took Israel to a place that was, that is so extreme that even as we see this attack from Hamas, I think, you know, ultimately his inability to provide a response that will provide long-lasting security for Israelis is also going to, you know, factor in here. And I think Israelis are slowly starting to realize that no amount of military force without a political path is going to provide them with the security that they want. So, you know, I don't see how he can go get out of this with a positive legacy. I just don't see it happening. I don't see how he can come out of this victorious or with a legacy that isn't completely tarnished by what is the worst attack Israel has ever experienced, or at least since 1948. And as he has said, the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. I mean, you know, he might not be taking responsibility for it, but everybody understands that he is, you know, in large part responsible, not just for the last year, but for years of Israeli policies led by him that have led us to this point. So I do think that he really sees himself as this kind of protector of the Jewish people. But ultimately, what has defined his career is, and certainly in the last few years, is that he's interested only in preserving himself and his own self-interests and his political, you know, survival. I don't see his legacy being anything but failing to provide Israelis with the safety and security that he, you know, has so boasted that he could provide for them. It's really unparalleled, I think, in history, what has happened under his watch. And Israelis, I think, will be, I don't see him coming out of this. I think Israelis will eventually call for him to be removed. He will eventually have to resign or be removed. And it will be very hard for him to salvage a positive legacy out of this.
And that was Merav Zonshein of the International Crisis Group. We're going to be continuing with our focus on the crisis in Israel and Palestine over the next few weeks. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.